God, we're grateful for just a beautiful day. We're grateful for this breath and the next. We're grateful. Perhaps maybe the spiritual discipline we need to develop more and more is this gratitude for all that we've been given. And this morning, we're grateful for our church and for this community of people you're bringing together and for what you're doing among us. It's just a joy to hear the stories of people who are taking the next step all the time. And we're very diverse and we're different and we think different ways about a lot of things, but yet we come together around this central cause. And I think that's a beautiful thing. So thank you for that. As we open the Bible, as we look at this a story that is has been for me very, very challenging and interesting and exciting, I pray that you'll help me to present this well and that we will just, at the end of all this, we'll reflect real deeply about what it means for us. We love you. We thank you. We pray in Jesus' name. And everybody said, amen. So this morning, there are really two stories I wanted to talk about that in the chapter we're at in the book, We Make the Road by Walking. I wanted to do both of these stories, but I realized the sermon would probably last 2 hours, and I just didn't think you guys would sign up for that. So I'm going to look this morning at a story about two brothers named Esau and Jacob, and the other story I want to look at is the story of Joseph. So I just encourage you to go to Genesis at some point this week and read the story of Joseph, because it's a really interesting story. It's a story we've used here before, but I would just encourage you to read it. It's a great story. So, but today we're going to look at Jacob and Esau. And I got to tell you, we're going to, if you're one of those people who like loves to hear the Bible read, you're going to hear a lot of the Bible read this morning. Because I thought I could just tell you this story and just tell you where it's at in the Bible. But this story is so well written, it would be wrong for me just to tell it to you. I'm going to read it to you because the writer of Genesis, whoever wrote this part, was brilliant and a little bit funny. And so we'll jump into that in a minute. But before we do that, I just want to remind you where we're at. We've been talking about how God made a good world in creation. And then humans initiate this crisis with all sorts of rivalry and violence. And the world kind of begins to unravel at the seams. And then God calls this man, Abraham, to begin to make a difference in this world. And whatever God's going to do, it's going to be through this guy, Abraham's family, who's going to be bigger, harder to count than the stars of the sky, and that through Abraham's family, God is going to bless them so that they can in turn bless the world. So this is where we've been. Now let's think about this crisis. I don't think I have to convince you that our world is still in crisis in a lot of ways. What can be done about the rising crisis in the world? And here's what's been tried in the Bible so far. The world's falling apart. You could kill everyone in a massive flood, right? Like that was tried in Genesis with the story of Noah. Did that work? Did that fix the world? No, because 10 minutes after he got off the boat, Noah was drunk and naked and making all sorts of mistakes, right? I mean, that quick, everything falls apart again. So that didn't work. Well, maybe we can confuse their languages so they all can't work together. Did that work? Well, they stopped building Babel, but we've actually probably fought more and been more at each other's throats, and there's probably been more violence in the world over misunderstanding one another. I don't know if you've noticed that, but it's a lot of times violence is a result of a misunderstanding, and so that didn't work. What is God going to do to fix the world? What's he going to do? How's God going to begin to repair the problem? How's God going to begin to reverse the crisis? And I believe the story we're going to look at today gives us an interesting window into how God actually is trying to turn things around in creation. And we're going to begin in Genesis 25. And last time we saw Isaac, the son of Abraham, where was he? The last time we saw Isaac, he was bound on an altar with his father about to sacrifice him to God. This is years later, after many, many sessions of therapy, we're going to see Isaac again. And this time, Isaac is about to have a family of his own. Genesis 25, these are the descendants of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham became the father of Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean, and the sister of Laban, the Aramean, from Padan Aram. Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife since she was unable to have children. Now, does this story sound familiar? Abraham and his wife Sarah were married, and what couldn't they do? Couldn't have children. And so when they were quite old, around 90, 100 years old, what happens? They have a son. Now we have Isaac and Rebekah, and what can't happen? She can't have children. And what you'll find out is the guy Jacob we're about to meet, he later has a wife named Rachel, and guess what? Couldn't have children. Then you come to the New Testament. Well, actually, later in the Old Testament, there's a woman named Hannah who can't have a child, and she prays, and God gives her Samuel, who is the last of the judges. And then you come to the New Testament. There's a woman named Elizabeth who can't have a baby, and she's very old. And guess what happens to Elizabeth? Anybody want to guess? She has a baby, and his name is John, and he's a wild man. And then there's a young girl named Mary. And what does she do? She has a baby. Okay, you know the story of Jesus, right? I mean, this is kind of an important part of the story. This young virgin girl named Mary has a baby. These are interesting stories, aren't they? So much of what happens in the Bible, and I really think Jesus and John, the New Testament writers want us to see this, right? Unlikely pregnancies, things that shouldn't be happening. And when you see this in just a minute, Isaac, they're going to have a baby when, they're going to have their kids when Isaac is 60. Now, some people like to take those ages literally. I mean, how many of you can imagine at 60 having twins? How, you know, those of you who do, like, have twins, you know, and you had them maybe in your 20s or 30s, I can't imagine what that was like. But that's a lot of responsibility, right? Two kids at once, and Isaac is 60. Like, he's supposed to be retiring. He's supposed to be, you know, getting onto that point in life, and now he's going to... Do we need to take those ages literally? You can if you want. I really don't think so. I think part of the point of those stories of people having babies when they're 60 and 100 and they've been unable to have children their whole lives, I think part of the power of those stories is it's saying to us, when we reach our limits and when we think it's actually impossible, that's the moment when God really begins to work, right? It's when we come to the end of ourselves that we can begin to see God do what God does. I think that's part of what those stories are trying to tell us. But you believe what you want. The Lord was moved by his prayer, and his wife Rebecca became pregnant, but the boys pushed against each other inside of her, and she said, "If this is what it's like, why did it happen to me?" Said every pregnant woman ever, right? "If this is what it's like, why did it happen to me?" So she went to ask the Lord. In the ancient world, people would go to like oracles, or we would call them today sort of like a medium. And that's how they would try to interact with God. So this is a very ancient story. She went to this place and asked God, "What's going on?" The Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two different peoples will emerge from your body. One people will be stronger than the other. The older will serve the younger." When she reached the end of her pregnancy, she discovered that she had twins. The first came out red all over, clothed with hair, and she named him Esau, which means red. Immediately afterward, his brother came out, gripping Esau's heel, and she named him Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when they were born. First impressions of this story. What do you do if you're a parent and your kid comes out covered in hair? This is an odd story, isn't it? By the way, I don't know if you follow archaeology, but it's part of my geekdom is loving archaeology. And this week, this is totally unrelated, but this week they announced that they found this temple site in Israel that was probably a temple to Baal that's very old, and they're unearthing it, which I found interesting. So I love archaeology. I love reading about archaeology. They actually uncovered an ancient depiction of Jacob and Esau. Did you see this? It's actually quite old. It came out in like the late 70s, early 80s. They found this ancient portrait of Jacob and Esau, it looks eerily like Chewbacca and Han Solo, but it's actually Jacob and Esau. Can you imagine giving birth to that? I mean, his first words like, I can't even make that noise, but that's the first sound he makes, is that Chewbacca sound. So this is the boys. They come into the world, and even in the womb, there's conflict. Siblings haven't fared well in the Bible so far. You had Cain and Abel, and how'd that go? Went really poorly. You had Isaac and Ishmael, and how'd that go? Pretty poorly. And now you have Esau and Jacob. Esau is older. How do you think this is going to go? Before they ever enter the world, they're arguing. They're pushing back and forth. And when they do enter the world, Esau's the oldest, but Jacob is gripping his heel. The word Jacob means like supplanter or trickster. And a Hebrew idiom for that, a Hebrew way of saying that is he grasps the heel. So right away, we've been told something. Esau is Irish and he's hairy. And Jacob is going to be this guy who probably isn't going to be the most upstanding citizen. He's a trickster. He's going to be conniving. He's going to be manipulative. He's going to be a mess, and he's going to be trouble. So the story continues. When the young men grew up, Esau became an outdoorsman who knew how to hunt And Jacob became a quiet man who stayed at home. So there's this contrast. Like, Esau is of the Ted Nugent variety, and Jacob is a stay-at-home son. That's basically what we're being told here, right? This is the variety. Esau's out in the field, and he's killing stuff, and he's mounting it and hanging it on the wall of their tent. And Jacob is not, he's kind of just hanging around the house, helping mom, doing those kind of things. Isaac loved Esau because he enjoyed eating game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Do you see any problems? Yeah, when people tell you the Bible is a book of family values, they've never read the Bible. Right? The Bible is much more of a do not ever do this to your children book than it is here's how you raise good children. I mean, what you find in Genesis over and over again, you know what Jacob's going to do? Jacob's going to grow up and he's going to have, and we'll talk about this in a minute, he's going to have two wives and he's going to have a son by one of those wives who he loves more than the others. And he gives him a technicolor dream coat. His name is Joseph. And Joseph ends up paying the price for his father's favoritism. So bad parenting all over the place in Genesis. It's much more descriptive than it is prescriptive. I don't think God actually wants us to treat our kids this way. So right away, they're very different boys. Esau is kind of this rugged, manly man, and Jacob's not. And Esau has his father's love, but Jacob has his mother's love. Once when Jacob was boiling stew, Esau came in from the field hungry and said to Jacob, "I'm starving. Let me devour some of this red stuff." That's why his name is Edom. Edom means red as well. So he comes home. He's been hunting. Apparently, he's had zero success. And he sees that Jacob is cooking some stew. And Esau's like, "I am starving to death." How many of you hear somebody say that? "I'm starving to death." And what do you want to tell them? You're not starving to death, right? Starving to death is over a period of time with no nourishment. I mean, it's not probably going to happen to any of us in this room today, right? So right away, Esau is kind of overhyping his hunger. You can tell right away he's not in a good frame of mind. Jacob said, Esau's like, "Please give me something to eat." What would you say to your brother who asked for something to eat? "Here's a bowl." What does Jacob say? "Sell me your birthright today." Is this premeditated? Yeah. This is like, I'm going to find the moment when I can trick my brother into giving me. And a birthright in the ancient world meant that the oldest son would get the bulk of it, at least a double portion of the inheritance. So land, animals, wealth, which all that stuff was tied up in, prestige, honor in the community, all that would go to the firstborn. And Jacob, he's been gripping Esau's heel since the womb, and now Jacob sees his shot to kind of get some of this for himself, and he says, "Sell me your birthright." Esau said, "Since I'm going to die anyway, what good is my birthright to me?" And the Oscar for best performance goes to who? Esau. I mean, he's really, really overhyping this. "Give me your word today," Jacob said, and he did. He sold his birthright to Jacob. So Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew. He ate, drank, got up and left, showing just how little he thought of his birthright. The book of Hebrews actually says, a Christian writer says to the Christians he's writing to, don't be godless like Esau, who despised. I mean, Esau, he's really become a heel for what he's done here. And really, I mean, Esau makes a poor decision, right? He sells his inheritance, and he probably would have been fine. He probably, you know, if he went and told his dad, I'm sure his dad would have made Jacob share, right? But he just kind of gives in to a momentary craving. And he sells everything that matters to feed a momentary craving. And I'm just going to let that sit right there, because how many times are we in that situation doing the same sort of thing? So the story continues. A bit later, Isaac had grown old, and his eyesight was failing. He summoned his older son Esau and said to him, "My son." And Esau said, "I'm here." He said, "I'm old and don't know when I will die. So now take your hunting gear, your bow and quiver of arrows, go out to the field and hunt game for me. Make me the delicious food that I love and bring it to me so I can eat. Then I can bless you before I die." So Esau goes out into the field to hunt and to prepare a meal. And in the ancient world, words mattered. So they actually believed that when you spoke over, especially a father speaking over his children, when you spoke over your children's life, that what you said would actually influence the trajectory of their lives. So when he does this, he wants to bless Esau and send him in a positive direction. They actually believed what they said mattered. Now, I think we know that I don't have the power to tell you and to like predict your future for you. But think about this. The way we speak to our kids, and even the way we speak to one another, sometimes if you tell your kids and you're harsh with your kids and you're always hard on them, and you speak certain things in their lives. Have you known people that that happened to them and it sent their life in a specific direction? It almost became a self-fulfilling prophecy, didn't it? And so our words matter, and they realize this, that they believe that when they spoke good things would happen. When they spoke bad things would happen. And so Isaac wants to bless his older son before he dies. But guess who overhears this conversation? Rebecca. And Rebecca goes to Jacob and she says, Jacob, this is the moment we've been waiting for. Your father is about to give Esau the blessing. Here's what we're going to do. Go get a couple goats and kill them. Bring them to me and I'll make some food and you take it into your father. And Jacob's, oh, Mom, it's part of a good idea, but Esau is like a rug. And I am like, a hairless chihuahua. We're not comparable. So when I go in there, if Dad touches me, he's going to know, hey, this is smooth, clean-shaven Jacob here. Where's Esau? And so the mother says, here's what we'll do. The goats you kill, I think this is supposed to be funny. I think we're supposed to laugh at this. Take the hair from the goats, the goat hide, and tie it on your arms and all over you. How hairy is Esau? Right? I mean, goat skin with hair on it is the equivalent of what Esau has going on. And so she says, tie the hair up around you and so that when you go in, your father will feel the goat fur and he'll think it's Esau. And so Jacob went into his father and said, my father. And he said, I'm here. Who are you, my son? Jacob said to his father, I'm Esau, your oldest son. I've made what you asked me to. Sit up and eat some of the game so you can bless me. Isaac said to his son, how could you find this so quickly, my son? Jacob replies, the Lord your God led me right to it. He uses God as a part of his deception. How many of us would do that? Let me ask you this. How many of you ever said this? I swear to God, right before you told the biggest lie that had ever been told on the face of the planet. Yeah. This is what he's doing. He's like, Dad, I swear to God. God just showed me where it was at. It was unbelievable. I was like in a trance and I walked out and there it was. God took over and gave me success. Isaac said to Jacob, come here and let me touch you, my son. Are you my son Esau or not? So Isaac, he's blind. He can't see, but there's this sense. He knows something seems off. So Jacob approached his father, Isaac, and Isaac touched him and said, the voice is Jacob's voice, but the arms are Esau's arms. This is hilarious to me. He's got goat fur, and it's just funny. Isaac didn't recognize him because his arms were hairy like Esau's arms. So he blessed him. Isaac said, are you really my son Esau? And he said, I am. Isaac said, bring me some food here. Let me eat some of my son's game so I can bless you. Jacob put it before him, and he ate, and he brought him wine, and he drank. His father Isaac said to him, come here and kiss me, my son. So he came close and kissed him. And by the way, Jacob is also wearing Esau's clothes as well. So he's really got he's in character here. When Isaac smelled the scent of his clothes, he blessed him. See, the scent of my son is like the scent of the field that the Lord has blessed. May God give you showers from the sky, olive oil from the earth, plenty of grain and new wine. May the nations serve you. May peoples bow down to you. Be the most powerful man among your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Those who curse you will be cursed, and those who bless you will be blessed. It totally worked. And I think we're supposed to see Isaac as kind of a failure as a parent here, because he's easily tricked into believing that his son is somebody he's not. And Jacob and his mother have schemed, and everything worked, and now Jacob, who is the second born, is getting the blessing of the firstborn. After Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, and just as Jacob left, his father Isaac, his brother Esau, came back from the hunt. I think this is the moment where, if this were a play on stage, you would see Jacob go one way, and then Esau would come in, and there would be this kind of music going on. Dum, dum, dum. Because it's about to get real. And what happens? What would you do? Let me go back. I don't want you to read it yet. What would you do if you were Esau in this situation? What'd you do? Birthright? Gone. Blessing? Gone. What do? Kill your brother. Homicide is on the table at this point, right? Notice what happens to what Esau does. He too made some delicious food and he brought it to his father and said, let my father sit up and eat from his son's game that you may bless me. His father said to him, who are you? He said, I am your son, your oldest Esau. Isaac was so shocked that he trembled violently. He said, who was the hunter just here with the game? He brought me food and I ate all of it before you came. I blessed him and he will stay blessed. When Esau heard what his father said, he let out a loud agonizing cry and wept bitterly. He said to his father, "Bless me, me too, my father." Isaac said, "Your brother has already come deceitfully and taken your blessing." Esau said, "Isn't this why he's called Jacob? He has taken me twice now. He took my birthright and now he's taken my blessing." He continued, "Haven't you saved a blessing for me?" Isaac replied to Esau, "I've already made him more powerful than you. I've made all of his brothers his servants. I've made him strong with grain and wine. What can I do for you, my son?" Esau said to his father, "Do you really have only one blessing, father? Bless me too, my father." And Esau wept loudly. This is a manly man. You just kind of imagine Esau's the kind of guy, if you were watching a romantic comedy and the tears started to fall, he would just will it to go back up in there. You know what I mean? Like, this is Esau. And he breaks completely down. And his father goes on to bless him, but you can read it in the Bible. It goes something like this. You're going to experience violence all your days. You're going to be a wanderer. You're not going to have anything. Your life's going to be terrible. I mean, this is the blessing that Isaac gives to his son. And Esau wept loudly. And then Esau was furious at Jacob because his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, "When the period of mourning for the death of my father is over, I will kill my brother." Now, I know we're at church and murder is totally wrong. But how many of you can kind of sympathize with Esau here? Nobody? You must be better people than most. Statistics tell me that some of you would be like sharpening the axe blade here. Some of us would really, really be hacked off. Because in the ancient world, everything Esau had, his whole future, everything has been stolen right out from underneath him. When I used to read this story, and when I had people tell me this story growing up, I really used to think that Jacob was the good guy. Is Jacob the good guy? Do you think Jacob's the kind of person at this point that God wants you to be like? Is this the kind of behavior God sanctions? Is this really how God's going to fix the world? Through this messy, muddled up, completely backwards, dysfunctional family? Is this how God's going to do it? Well, Rebecca, ever the eavesdropper, overhears Esau. I mean, if you're going to plot this, you should never say it out loud. He's saying it out loud. His mother overhears, and she goes to Jacob, and she says, "Listen, here's the deal. Esau wants to kill you. So, you need to go stay at my brother Laban's house." And she actually says something like this: when Esau gets over it and forgets about it, you can come back. How many of you would forget about this? Like, what does that take? A week, 2 weeks, a month, a year? When do you forget about the guy who took your birthright and your blessing and ruined your entire life? You don't forget that. That's not going to be like, "Man, until you reminded me about Jacob and what a jerk he was, I totally forgot." I mean, this is going to stick with Esau. So Jacob flees. And on his journey, a lot of interesting things happen. Jacob has this encounter with God. It's a dream where he sees a stairway reaching to heaven. And he has this encounter with God where God essentially is trying to call Jacob onto the right path. And if Jacob will follow the right path, then good things are going to happen for him and his family. Jacob goes on to live with Laban. And while he's there, Laban has two daughters. One's name was Lee, and the other's name was Rachel. The text tells us that Rachel is very beautiful. And it tells us that Lee had weak eyes. Do you know what that's a euphemism for in the Bible? If it says you have weak eyes, it means you are ugly. So Jacob goes, and he is smitten with Rachel, and he says to her father Laban, "I would really like to marry Rachel." And he says, "Here's what we'll do. You work for me for 7 years, and I'll give you Rachel. She'll be your wife." Jacob puts in his 7 years, and like it's sundown on the last day of work. He's like, "I'm ready. I'm ready to marry this woman. I put in 7 years." And Laban says, "All right, let's do this." And they have this wedding, and she would have been veiled in the ancient world, so he actually wouldn't probably have seen her face until after the wedding. He wakes up the next morning, and he looks at his bride, and he discovers this isn't Rachel. It's her ugly sister. This is what some people would call a coyote ugly moment. Right, this is when he is trying to gnaw his arm off and get out of the room. This is bad. This is not good. And Jacob goes back to Laban. And by the way, don't you kind of like seeing Jacob get his a little bit? I mean, he has met his match in Laban. Laban is just a big of a trickster. And Jacob didn't get it from a stranger. It's been passed down. And you kind of like seeing Jacob get his. And so he comes back and he says, "How could you do? You gave me the ugly sister and I wanted the hot girl. And you gave me the ugly one. I want Rachel now." And he says, "I'll tell you what. You worked for me for 7 years and I'll give you Rachel." So he works 7 more years and eventually he gets to marry Rachel. Interesting. Lee can have kids. Rachel cannot. But eventually, Rachel has a son. She eventually has two, but in this story, she has one, and his name is Joseph of the Technicolor Dreamcoat fame. And guess what? Joseph and Rachel are the favorites, and Joseph's favorite status ends up getting him in all kinds of trouble with his brothers, if you keep reading the story. Jacob is repeating the same mistakes his parents made. So Jacob eventually, he lives with Laban for around 20 years he's there, and he does well, and he makes lots of money, and he ends up leaving Laban's house with a lot more than he had this sense that God had told him to go home, that 20 years had been long enough, and he needed to go back to his land of ancestry, and he needed to go back and be there. And the problem is, to go home, he has to go through a place called Edom. And who lives in Edom? Esau lives in Edom. It's this moment where Jacob has come full circle. And he's not the... In some ways, he's still the man he was. He's just older. And he decides to set out home. And when he gets close to Edom, he sent messengers ahead of him to his brother Esau toward the land of Seir, the open country of Edom. He gave them these orders. Say to my what? Master Esau. Do you know what this is? A very technical Hebrew term for what this is? It's called sucking up. Right? This is Jacob demonstrating the art of the brown nose. Because what he's saying here is, I've totally messed this guy over multiple times, but I'm going to send my messengers and I'm going to say, Master Esau, even though my father said I'm better than you. Master Esau. This is the message of your servant Jacob. I've lived as an immigrant with Laban, where I've stayed till now. I own cattle, donkeys, flocks, men servants, and women servants. I'm sending this message to my master now to ask that he be kind. Here's what he's saying. I've got tons of stuff. I don't need anything from you. I just want to go home. Will you let me pass through your territory? The messengers returned to Jacob and said, we went out to your brother Esau, and he's coming to meet you with 400 men. This is where Jacob soils his robe, right? I mean, this is the moment where it gets real. Esau is coming. He's not waiting on you to come to him. He's coming to you. And by the way, he's got 400 of his hairiest, bloodthirsty friends with him. What do you do if you're Jacob? There is no going back. He's coming to you. So Jacob devises a plan. He was terrified and felt trapped. So he divided the people with him and the flocks, cattle, and camels into two camps. He thought if Esau meets the first camp and attacks it, at least one camp will be left to escape. This is the sentimentality of the ancient world. If I lose half of them, at least I'll have the other half. Guess which group he put in the first camp? The ugly wife, right? He sends her and all of her kids and her servants first, and then he puts his favorite in the back. And so what happens? Jacob separates his family into two camps, and that night, he ends up going off by himself, and the text just, I mean, this is really a random, abrupt thing that happens in the story. The text just immediately says, he wrestled with a man till daybreak, and that Jacob was wrestling with this man who he couldn't beat, and they're wrestling, and they're wrestling, and they're wrestling, and they're wrestling, and finally, Jacob grabs hold of him. And what's very interesting about this is Jacob entered the world grasping Esau's heel, and he'd been grasping Esau's birthright. And he'd been grasping Esau's blessing. All his life, he'd been grasping after the wrong things, hadn't he? He'd been grasping after what other people had. He'd been grasping after what he wanted. It had been a very self-motivated, selfish human being. And in this moment, Jacob grasps this man he's wrestling, and he refuses to let go. And the man says, let me go. It's almost daybreak. And Jacob says, I will not let you go until you bless me. And the man says to Jacob, what is your name? The last time Jacob gets asked that, what does he say? I'm Esau. This time, Jacob is faced with who he really is, and he says, he owns up, my name is Jacob. And the man says, that's not your name. You think they would let him sit with that for a few minutes. He finally owned up to who he was. But the man says to him, that's not your name anymore. Your name now is Israel, because you have wrestled with humans and God, and you've not been prevailed over. He changes his name. And then Jacob, after the man goes away, he touches Jacob in the hip and it injures him, and the man disappears, he leaves. And Jacob says, he names the place, and he says that it's because he wrestled with God and he saw God. He interpreted it to be God, and he said, I saw God face to face and I lived. Now, we understand there are issues thinking that God is a human being, because God's not a human being. But Jacob has this encounter where he says, I in some way came face to face with the divine, and I lived to tell the story. And then morning comes. And it's time to pay the piper. Esau. Jacob looks up and he sees Esau approaching with 400 men. Jacob divided the children among Lee, Rachel, and the two women servants. He put the servants and their children first, Lee and her children after them, and Rachel and Joseph last. Do you think they knew, like, they were in line based on expendability? So the slaves go up here. We'll put the not-so-happy favorite wife here, and then we'll put my favorite in the back. He himself went in front of them and bowed to the ground 7 times as he was approaching his brother. Do you know what? When I read that, you know the one thing that pops in my mind? Wayne's World. We're not worthy. We're not worthy. I just imagine that this is Jacob. We're not worthy. We're not worthy. 7 times. If you're Esau and you see this coming, what are you doing? I mean, this guy is the dumbest guy. Look at him. He is scared to death. He is scared to death. Me and my 400 hairy men, we finally have him where we want him. And what would you do right now if you're Esau? Loot. Gloat. And then loot, right? You gloat and then you loot. You take all his stuff and you gloat because he's vulnerable and you're powerful. Notice what happens. Esau ran. Can you imagine what Jacob felt like when he saw his brother running at him? He's like, oh, this is worse than I expected. He's not even walking. You know, at least in scary movies, the serial killer walks really slowly behind you. This guy's running at me. Esau ran to meet him, threw his arms around his neck, kissed him, and they wept. Is this what you expected in the story? If you've never heard this story before, is this what you expect? No, this is not a Hollywood action adventure flick, is it? Esau runs to his brother, embraces him, kissed him, and they begin to cry together. Esau looked up and saw the women and children and said, who are these with you? Jacob said, these are the children that God graciously gave your servant. The women's servants and their children came forward and bowed down. Leah and her servants also came forward and bowed down. And afterward, Joseph and Rachel came forward and bowed. Esau said, what's the meaning of this entire group of animals that I met? Jacob said, to ask for my master's kindness. It's a peace offering. Esau said, I have plenty, my brother. Keep what's yours. Esau is completely mistreated by his family. And yet, God has taken care of him. Do you see what that? I think that's part of what the story's trying to say. He's been completely given a bad deal, and yet God has provided for Esau. His father had nothing good to say for him, but God has provided for Esau. Jacob said, no, please do me this kindness of accepting my gift. Now, this, I got to tell you, this next line, I've read this story a bunch. I've preached this story a bunch. I never saw this next line until listening to Brian McLaren in this book. I never saw this line. This line, to me, has changed the entire way I read the story. Notice what Jacob says to his brother. Remember, he's just been wrestling with God. And he says to Esau, seeing your face is like seeing what? God's face. What was Jacob wrestling with? I think Jacob, he's wrestling with his past, with his false identity he's constructed, with his scheming, with his conniving, with all the ways he's kind of made a mess of his world and the way that other people have kind of become collateral damage in his thirst and lust for power and wealth and dominance. And he says to Esau, who I always thought was the bad guy in this story, seeing your face, it's like looking at God. Is that shocking to you? The guy who we thought was the bad guy in the story actually ends up being the good guy. Jacob has been the bad guy. And all of his trouble caught up with him. And the moment when he has to pay the piper, he finds not condemnation, not hatred, not a demand for vengeance. He finds grace, compassion, and love. So, he says, seeing your face is like seeing God's face since you've accepted me so warmly. Take this present that I've brought because God has been generous to me and I have everything I need. So Jacob persuaded him. And he took it. How does God begin to put the world right? Killing a bunch of people doesn't work. Confusing everything doesn't work. How is God going to save the world? How would you respond to Esau? Or how would you expect Esau to respond, right? Violence, right? Getting him back, doing to him what he's done to us. How does Jacob respond? I mean, don't miss the significance of that moment when he looks his brother in the eyes and says, looking at you is like seeing God face to face. Powerful. What does this story tell us about how God's going to put everything right? And I think this is what it tells us. Things won't be fixed through payback. Ever. How many of you have ever been in a personal conflict where paying them back made peace and ended everything? Right? They gossiped about me. So I'm going to gossip about them in an equal way, and that's going to end it, right? Everybody's going to say, you got me. I deserved it. Is that what happens? When one person punches another person and the other person returns the punch, what happens then? Well, we're even. No, that's not what happens, right? Revenge leads to revenge. The reason the Old Testament says eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, it's because it was trying to keep ancient people from doing what people do. You burn down my crops, I'm going to kill your whole family. No. If they injure your field, you injure their field. If they cut off your arm, you cut off their arm. Eye for an eye, right? It's this sense, this way of trying to say, let's think about how we're living here. Payback never fixes anything. And that's on a global scale, right? You can't bomb your way to peace. And in a personal level, you can't bomb your way to peace. You can't bully people, beat people up, argue with people, hurt people, give people exactly what they've given you and ever expect for the relationship to be healed. Doesn't work that way. Payback leads to payback leads to payback. And it's a cycle and it's vicious and it keeps going. And what always happens is it grows and grows and grows. And eventually innocent people are being caught in the crossfire. God is not going to fix the world through payback. He's not going to fix the world through paying us back for all the bad things we've done, because that's not going to fix the world. God is going to fix the world through forgiveness and reconciliation, through a brother who stands in front of the one who has lied to him, tricked him, stolen from him, wounded him in the deepest ways. And instead of giving back what he had been given, he gives grace and compassion and forgiveness instead. So what does all this have to do with us? Right, that's why we read the Bible, right? It's great to hear about what happened then, but I think what we want to know is, what does this mean for us? And I love how Brian ends this chapter in the book. He says, as in Genesis, life today is full of rivalries and conflicts. We all experience wrongs, hurts, and injustices through the actions of others. And we all inflict wrongs, hurts, and injustices upon others. I think that's the important thing to begin with. We all have been hurt by others, but whether we're even cognizant of it, whether we're aware of it, we have all also hurt others. I like to believe I've never hurt a living soul, but sometimes I find out that I have, that sometimes something I've done or haven't done, that a word I've said or a word I needed to say that I didn't say, that in some way I've brought pain and hurt into somebody else's life. That's just true. We all are at both ends of that. We give hurt and we get hurt. That's just true. If we want to reflect the image of God, remember, what did God make people to do? Reflect his image to the world. If we want to reflect God's image, we will choose grace over hostility, reconciliation over revenge, and equality over rivalry. When we make that choice, we encounter God in the faces of our former rivals and enemies. And as we are humbled, surrendering to God, and seeking to be reconciled with others, our faces too reflect the face of God. We come alive as God's image bearers, indeed. We've been talking about what it means to be truly alive, to have true aliveness. What if true aliveness is seeing the face of God in your enemy? In the one you've wounded. I mean, you want a powerful image of this? Go to the New Testament. As Jesus is being executed, he prays this compassionate prayer for his executioners. Father, what? Forgive, forgive, forgive. Because the world doesn't get better with hate, and the world doesn't get better by paying them back. The world only gets better when somebody steps out of the cycle of violence and retribution and says, I'm not playing by those rules. I'm choosing to forgive. Now, a couple things. Forgiveness is not a decision, it is a journey. Anybody who's ever been wounded knows you cannot just decide to forgive somebody on the spot. Doesn't happen. You may think it does, but you'll leave, and guess what? You think Esau walked away from this going, you know, I totally forgot about that time Jacob stole my birthright. Remember that time he snuck in and took my blessing? I totally forgot about that. Just totally gone. No. I mean, Jacob and Esau, they talk about traveling on together at the end of the story, but they decide to part ways because they don't need to be right up next to each other. Sometimes people refuse to reconcile with us, and so we have to forgive them from afar. Sometimes reconciliation is not possible. I can tell you there are people in my life who for years I've really wanted to make peace with, but they refuse. And so there's this sense of like, how long, like, what do you do? Do you let it continue to eat you up, or do you say, I need to move on and forgive them from a distance? And in the moment they're ready to talk about reconciliation, I'm leaving that door open. But I'm going to try to forgive them. And right now being around them would be more painful and it would make it harder to forgive them. Do you have those people in your life? Like, it's to forgive them, you need to be in a different zip code. Or they need to be in a different country. And you'd be happy to pay their airfare and moving expenses to get them there. But there's this sense of, yes, the goal is always reconciliation, but sometimes that takes long periods of time. And sometimes that just is impossible based on who you're dealing with. I think the power of this story is, though, is it's reminding us that to really be alive is to reflect God's image well, but it's to see God's image in other people. And it's in Esau, the wounded one, the one who he had hurt and mistreated, Jacob begins to see God more clearly. And I would argue that this encounter changes Jacob. He's not going to be able to be the same anymore. He still makes tons of mistakes, but he makes them differently in some ways because he's a different person. So let's leave with this. A few questions. Whose Esau am I? Some of you are here today and you've been really hurt by somebody. You've been wounded. You've been betrayed. You've been mistreated. You've been lied about. You've been stolen from. You name it, it's happened to you, and you can put a name, a face, and a date on it. You're somebody's Esau. And some of us here are the Jacobs of the story, and we're probably playing dual roles here. But some of us have been the Jacobs. We've hurt, we've mistreated, we've lied about, we've gossiped about, we've stolen from, we've taken, we've wounded, we've hurt, we've left collateral damage. And as we're thinking about those relationships where we play the Esau or we play the Jacob, maybe this is the question we need to ask. What would it look like to reflect God's image in these relationships? If I'm the Esau in this story, what would it look like for me to reflect God's image to those who have wounded me? What would it look like for me to show them what God's like and to show them God's love and compassion, because that is how the world gets put back together? If I'm the Jacob, what would it look like for me in humility to go back to the Esau's I've wounded and say to them, I was wrong and I'm sorry and I can't make this go away and I can't fix it. I can't blink my eyes or snap my fingers and make it all perfect. But I want to do whatever I can to help. And I want to do whatever I can to make peace possible between us. What would it look like for us to take seriously our vocation as human beings to reflect God's image to everybody who's around us? What would it look like if our enemies walked away and they said, seeing your face, when I was toast and you could have easily had me and paid me back, seeing your face was like seeing the face of God. Because you reflected God's love and grace to me in such a powerful, profound, generous way. And so I'm just going to ask, where you're at with these stories, thinking about where you're the Esau and where you're the Jacob and what it means to reflect God's image, I just want to have a word of prayer. And wherever you find yourself, maybe just take a moment to silently offer these situations and these people and these issues up to God, and then we'll dismiss. Let's have a word of prayer. God, I pray for the Esau's in the room, those who have been wounded, those who have been hurt, lied about, treated, taken advantage of, stolen from. We could easily choose the path of bitterness. We could easily choose the path of revenge. We could easily let this send us into a spiral in so many ways. Help us to be like Esau, who really ends up being the hero in the story. May we be so formed by your love and grace that we can only extend that to other people. May we be honest about our emotions and our anger and our hurt. May we not stuff that and pretend it and it's not there, but may we really deal with that with you, with close friends, with spiritual directors, people we trust. But may we enter into the long journey of forgiveness and, if possible, reconciliation. May we, as the hurt party, may we reflect your image to the people who have hurt us in whatever way we can, even if it's from a distance. And Father, for those of us who are the Jacobs, those of us who have stolen, hurt, lied about, gossiped about, wounded, may we first of all stop running. May we not run from our past and from our mistakes. May we own up to who we've been so that we can be given grace to become who we never imagined we could be. This is a journey of transformation, and us Jacobs, we need transformation. So meet us in our failure, meet us in our brokenness, meet us in the ways we've messed it all up. And with your grace, enable us to have the courage to turn around and head back and to seek peace, to reflect your image, to tell of your grace and your compassion and your mercy. Father, as we leave this place, may we leave with this question. Wherever we find ourselves, with whomever we find ourselves today, tomorrow, this week, How can we best reflect your image, regardless of the circumstances? What would it look like to choose this path that Esau has chosen? And God, we're thankful that when the Jacobs mess everything up, that you still care for the Esaus, and that you don't write them off, but you take care of them. We're grateful. We pray in Jesus' name. And everybody says, amen. Let's stand.